I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. I'm here today with Dr. Michael Nucitelli, a New York State licensed psychologist practicing in Brooklyn, who is also a cyber psychology researcher and online safety educator. Dr. Nucitelli launched iPredator in 2011 to provide education to consumers on cyberbullying, cyberstalking, online predation, cybercrime, and internet addiction. To learn more about iPredator, visit ipredator.co. Michael, welcome. It's so great to have you with us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me on. And hopefully all your listeners are both internet safe and COVID safe.
Yeah, true. Yeah, thank you for that. I hope that as well. So let's start by learning about how your career in psychology led you to being interested in cyberspace and ultimately starting iPredator.
Okay, well, my interest in psychology, actually, for those of your listeners that are baby boomers, X-gen, I'm 55, so I was born in 64. But in eighth grade, I fell in love with Suzanne Plichette from the Bob Newhart Show. God bless Suzanne Plichette. I knew then and there, if in order to meet Suzanne Plichette someday, I had to become a psychologist. So from grade on, it was either become a psychologist or become an astronomer, and I chose psychology. So from then on, I got my doctorate degree, and roughly in the early 2000s, I became interested in the forensic aspects. I became a forensic psychologist, doing evaluations in criminal court, the civil court, and then doing custody evaluations. I wrote a concept called dark psychology, which is available at my website for anybody to read and download. And then as time went on, I just became more and more fascinated studying, as I say, the dark side of human consciousness. For religious folks would be evil. And then also what I particularly like to study even now is psychopathy. And that's where my interest really started. And then not to draw it out, but actually, the more I studied about the criminal mind, I started to realize if I was a pedophile, if I was the depraved, if I was a criminal, well, where better could I go to hide my anonymity and be able to target others and not even get up off my chair? Well, that is cyberspace.
Right. And so can you share with us the concept of iPredator and the types of predatory activity that exists within that, I guess, dark side of cyberspace? We talk about cybercrime and cyber warfare and things like that, but what you cover is more, of course, centered around behavior, and that's very interesting.
Exactly, and thank you. It's actually iPredator, as I said, I wrote back in 2010, and that introduced typologies, behaviors, activities, and I'll say them real quickly. Those are cyber bullies, cyber harassers, cyber stalkers, cyber criminals, internet trolls, cyber terrorists, online predators, and then to me, the worst of the worst, online child pornography consumers and distributors. And those are essentially the eight types of online assailants. From there, it's very easy for any of your listeners, for any of us, if you want to assess if you're an iPredator, it's very basic. There's three basic criteria. One is if you are aware that you're causing harm to another online user, another group, whatever that may be. So that's the first criteria, which is a self-awareness that you're hurting, you're stealing, or you're defaming others. Number two, obviously, because it's a cyber criminal psychology concept, is the use of information and communication technology to hurt others, and that's using information. And then finally, number three is development and the strategizing of what I call cyber stealth. And what cyber stealth is not just online deception, but it also, you know, takes into consideration the planning and the strategy of manipulating others to meet, as I say, your bidding. And those are the three criteria. So if you meet those three criteria, you are an iPredator.
Interesting. And the way you described cyber stealth just now kind of made me think of like hunting. Do you think that's a fair analogy, sort of? Are people kind of like on the hunt, or How does that?
Well, they're definitely on the hunt. I mean, if you think of lowercase I, which back in 2007, Steve Jobs came up with the iPhone, and I thought that was quite cute. And my fascination with studying, you know, the criminal mind, obviously you have the predator, then you have the victim. So most certainly it's there's definitely a hunt. And now I guess the hunting grounds, if I may say, is cyberspace. And particularly, I mean, obviously cyberspace, but even the larger hunting ground is social media.
Right. And so on iPredator, you speak to the information and communications technology, or ICT. And how has that enabled cybercrime, cyber warfare, and other types of predatory activities?
Well, I think if you want to get basic, when we look at predator and prey, and I hate to use nature in the wild, but if you take, for instance, a praying mantis, well, a praying mantis is not only one of the most elegant insects to me, but she is a wonderful color of green, and she blends in well with the surrounding environment, so that when her prey, a beetle, let's say, comes along, she hides herself quite well. So the one quality that affords all cyber criminals, online child predators in cyberspace is what I call the veil of anonymity, or also the veil of invisibility. They can hide behind their computer screens. They don't have to get up off their chair if they're using a desktop.
Right.
Nowadays, everyone is using mobile devices. So essentially, they can be on the move. They can basically, target other folks without being identified.
Right. Very interesting. And do you think that that veil of anonymity has basically dehumanized this type of predatory behavior? I'm just thinking, you know, predators before the internet, it was all in the physical world. And even though they're able to disassociate and you know, view things as dehumanize things anyway, I wonder, like, has the internet aided in that in any way?
Well, that is, we're moving into, and thank you, but, and I won't believe, is you're moving into the philosophy of iPredator. It just, and as you said, in the pre-information age, prior to the 1980s, is that, you know, a criminal, a pedophile, whatever, they essentially had to get up, you know, out of their chair. They had to go out, get in their car to go offend. They had to face people. They had to, you know, they had to be, adept enough, skilled enough for breaking into people's homes.
Right.
Well, nowadays, behind the veil of anonymity in cyberspace, as I said earlier, I know it sounds a little cheesy, but cyber criminals and the iPredator, they literally do not have to leave their chair, and they can offend. They can steal thousands when it comes to identity theft.
Right.
And they can, you know, victimize children when it comes to online child predation. It's absolutely amazing. And it's only growing.
Right. Because when you say growing, I'm now thinking about how, pre-1980s, to your point, like, most people kind of, obviously there's always been rings of crime and things like that, but a lot of those people acted alone. But now you have a platform for people to come together and, like, organize everything in a very different way, and so I can foresee how that might be a way it's growing as well. Is that fair to say?
Most certainly. And unfortunately, when it comes to iPredator and the eight different typologies, obviously cyber terrorism, by the grace of God, here on American soil, we haven't dealt with that yet. Thank God. Hopefully I don't see it in my lifetime. We know that online child pornography, consumption and distribution is illegal. We know that online child predation is illegal. And we also know that cybercrime is illegal, but the other aspects, the other typologies of cyberbullying, cyber harassment, internet trolling, and cyber stalking, which is just beginning to be recognized as potentially illegal, they are all legal activities, and they are done on a daily basis, and they are causing, you know, those activities are causing a lot of harm to folks across the country.
Yeah, they really are. And I want to talk about cyberbullying for a little bit. That was a great segue into that, because The Social Dilemma is a documentary on Netflix. Well, it's like a half documentary, half scripted series, that episode that came out on Netflix. And everyone I know in my social circle is talking about it. They're asking me, have you watched that? I'm like, yes. but a lot of it I knew just by way of being in advertising and marketing. I understood that our data was being collected. Like, that wasn't new news to me. But what was new news to me was how they started to get into how, since the rise of social media, which their benchmark is around 2009, we've seen in preteens a 150% increase in suicides and a tripling of the rate of self-harm, which is incredibly alarming. I was a victim of cyberbullying once upon a time in the age of MySpace, so it's dating myself a little bit. All this other social media didn't exist yet, thank God. It was a girl that I knew that I went to high school with, so there wasn't really a ton of anonymity there. But I can only imagine now, with that anonymity and with bad actors finding a forum for cyberbullying, cyber harassment, that would just be taking off. But what type of behavior is contributing? Like, why is this happening? Is it, you know, why are we seeing this rise in suicides and self-harm?
Well, excellent question. I mean, we first have to take in consideration the information age, which is said to have begun as a period of history in the early 1980s. And as you said, with social media skyrocketing some around 2009 or 2010, children today, just like children 10 years, but more so now, literally live online. Right. Now that we are in a COVID environment, online learning, virtual learning environments is going to expand the amount of time children are spending online. Now, cyberbullying, as you know, is a child-on-child phenomena. It's a pediatric abuse phenomena. Of the eight typologies, obviously cyber harassment, cyber stalking, internet trolling can occur among children, but cyberbullying is the only one of the eight types that is exclusive to children. And what it comes down to is that, you know, children in the prepubescent, when they start puberty, all through puberty, so anywhere from 10 through 17 or 18, they are going through what's called identity formation. Mm. They're developing their identity. They are leaving the proverbial psychological comforts of family/primary caregiver, and they're moving to become, you know, essentially independent adults, and then to go off to college, vocational school, so forth and so on. So for them, and this has gone probably since the beginning of human civilization, is that for the teenager, the most important developmental milestone for them is peer acceptance. Mm. So children will do whatever they have to do to be recognized, to be validated, and to be accepted by their peer groups. Well, what more, where can they go now to be able to meet all those? That is online. And this is why we see the jump in Snapchat and TikTok and essentially just spending so much time online, because for them, they see it as a vehicle to be cool.
That makes sense. And you mentioned COVID-19, especially given our current world of quarantine in the wake of COVID-19 and isolation, that, you know, we know that a statistic recently came out here, I'm in Maine, how overdoses have, you know, skyrocketed past last year's total amount because of isolation. When people are alone, it's really hard. You don't have that support network. But as far as isolation and this type of activity, and especially cyberbullying, things like that, you also talk about something called offline distress, or ODDOR. So offline distress dictates online response. Can you walk us through that and how that relates to isolation as well?
Most certainly. And ODOR, offline distress dictates online response, that also serves the eye predator if he or she is good enough. So what ODOR is, offline distress dictates online response, in a nutshell means, however my offline life is going, whether I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm intoxicated, I'm angry, I'm preoccupied, I believe it directly impacts how I disseminate information, how I exchange information, and how I compile information, which, by the way, is the only three things we can do with information, is we can compile it, we can disseminate it, we can exchange it. But under the notion of odor, I believe, obviously this is anecdotal, I can't prove it yet, is that I believe how my offline psychological functioning is going to have a direct effect on how I interpret what I'm seeing online. So if I'm an upset young man or young woman, when I'm online, I am not going to be as rational as I would be as if I was in a relaxed state. Now, the eye predator looks for that. And what I call that is called the IVI, the eye predator victim intuition. And if an eye predator is skilled enough, he can go on to your Instagram, let's say you're in your early 20s and you're on Instagram and you're posting a lot of images that are sullen, that are dark, that speak to you being angry, or let's say speak to you being upset with your loved one, so forth and so on. If I'm a good eye predator, I can pick up that you're not a happy camper, and then I'm going to try to ally with you, and hopefully maybe we can connect. So the offline defense distress dictates online response is not only important for us as individuals and online users, but it's crucial for us to understand, in a nutshell, if we wear our emotions on our proverbial cyber sleeves, the online assailant, the eye predator, is going to pick that up.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And so as far as protecting ourselves, you have on iPredator.co a section for safety. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
The two, without going into detail and spending a lot of time, the two quickest things I can say to all online users. And first and foremost, I want your listeners to know is that after working on the weekend, since I wrote iPredator in 2010, I have volunteered after work on the weekends helping folks who've been attacked, who've been cyberstalked, famed. I can't, over the last 10 years, I can say there have been many. And what I have learned, obviously, not all of them, but one of the first things I want your listeners to understand is never, ever publish, post, suggest, concern, even if you do double entendre, do not share or post sexually suggestive information online. Even if you're in love with the man or the woman, even if you think you're going to spend the rest of your life together, do not sext, do not send, you know, sexy images. Certainly do not create, publish, and send and exchange videos. Because God forbid if the two of you end up breaking up, and God forbid if it ends up being an adversarial breakup, I can almost guarantee you, not in every occasion, that it will be used against you. And here we in the United States and in many industrialized nations, I'm sure you guys have heard about it as well as your listeners, we're now dealing with the two big phenomena of revenge porn and sextortion. And the few folks that I've helped that have had to deal with it, I wouldn't wish that upon my worst enemy. I can't imagine, Ms. Hillary, what it would be like to have to deal with that. I just can't imagine.
Right. No, that's terrifying. I can't imagine that either. And you shared that you've helped people in your free time, which I'm sure is super abundant, of course, but help people who have been victims. We talked to people who are, you know, who help victims of cybercrime. But this is an interesting angle as far as the mental health impact at being a victim of cybercrime. So what can people, if someone out there listening is a victim of cybercrime or cyber harassment, what have you, eye predator behavior, what can they do? I mean, they're not alone, of course. I know it can feel that way, especially now, but what should they be doing?
Well, first and foremost is, I mean, you know, being the Cybercrime Magazine, I'm sure you have disseminated an incredible amount of tips and help and how not to get targeted, not to be, suffer from identity theft. I mean, obviously you don't click on unfamiliar links.
my expertise is the psychology of the cyber criminal, the cyber criminal mind, the cyber stalker's mind, you know, is again, the psychology such as odor. Your psychological functioning has a lot to do with what you do online. Obviously, you can tell a person not to click on, you know, on links and attachments in your emails, which is, we would think is common sense.
But I can tell you, Hillary,
there has been times, it's been a while, where I've come home and in a state of, in a rush, I have gotten emails where I inadvertently clicked on a link I shouldn't have. Now, thank God it didn't, nothing happened. I didn't have malware or spyware, but I have to admit that in a rush, I clicked on them. So it goes back to this idea of understanding that, you know, the psychology, our mind, you know, has everything to do, you know, with whether or not we get hacked, whether or not, you know, we have our bank accounts intruded upon. Everything has to do with how our psychological state. And what I'm trying to offer the InfoSec and in the digital forensic worlds is I'm asking everyone to begin to understand you have the cyber criminal, but then you also have what I believe is cyber criminal psychology. Because what we have now that didn't exist in a pre-information world is the artificial abstract environment called cyberspace. And to me, that is a whole new frontier that those of us that are into, you know, whether it be law enforcement, information security, for those of us that are trying to help protect others, we have to understand this new environment, albeit it's not real, but to all of us, we act as if it's real. And we got to address that.
Right. And that brings me really nicely to the next question to build on that. So my undergrad is in psychology, which really every professor tells you this gives you no grounds to go to a Thanksgiving dinner and diagnose anyone or you conduct any type of talk therapy. But as a part of that education, I took psychopathology. I learned about deviant behavior, and you learn about the vulnerability stress model, which for anyone who doesn't know, my understanding, please correct me if I'm rusty on this, it states that severe psychological disorders can be attributed to vulnerabilities such as genetics or low social support, and then the combination with stressors such as economic adversity, severe poverty, and environmental trauma that creates kind of the platform for that psychological disorder. So that's what you learn about when you're learning about serial killers, which is such a hot topic now in our media and things like that. But I'm curious if you think that, especially in relation to cyber criminal psychology, if you think that that vulnerability stress model is applicable, or, you know, is it something else? Like, what are the factors at play that create iPredators or online psychopaths?
I'd give you a big Italian hug right now. I call it the stress diathesis model, where is, again, and it feeds directly into odor. I mean, obviously, in a pre-information age world, my subjective processing, my mental framework had and still does, has a direct influence on how I behave offline. Online, I can't explain why, but I certainly think that online something is going on. I can't prove it yet. The closest I've come to is, why do people respond differently online than they do offline? The only conclusion I can make right now, and I could be totally wrong, is that online, when I'm being targeted or I am in fear of being targeted, so let's say now I'm being trolled, and I'm anxious about who's trolling me, the fact that I'm not able to access all five senses, which, as you know, the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, when I'm offline, and if you're stalking me, Hillary, I can see you, whether it be in your car, driving past me, I can see you in my face, I can smell you, I can touch you if I have to. But in cyberspace, none of that exists. And I believe because as humans, and whether you believe in divine entities or not, we are social creatures. We are somewhat, you know, animals. We rely on our senses. In cyberspace, we don't have that. So we have to, you know, rely on other aspects, which is almost next to none. I mean, we can use our intellect, we can practice online safety, but when it comes to being able to understand who's targeting us, it's next to impossible. Then confounding that is also being at the beginning of the information age. There is not a system in place to help us. The vast majority of the folks that I help, they have already been told by their loved ones that they're being melodramatic or they're crazy, or to delete it and turn it off, that you're just obsessing on it. Now, mind you, some of them are obsessing, but the vast majority are truly being victimized, are truly afraid, but their loved ones are telling them they're crazy, and the system, law enforcement and the court systems, are not recognizing and taking their claims as serious.
Yeah, and the court angle is really interesting because I feel like there's just, I mean, for me, I actually brought the girl that was cyber bullying me to court to get a protection from harassment against her. But when I did this back in the early 2000s, there was no, you know, the judge didn't even know how to go about ruling because there was no case law. There was nothing. He was like, I don't even know what to call this. Like the term cyberbullying didn't even exist. So that's really confusing for people to navigate because they're like, it's not a tangible thing in our physical world, but obviously it has a very physical impact. And so how should a parent, you know, if a parent suspects that their child is being cyberbullied, like how should they go about that?
Well, first and foremost is that the parents need to, you know, sit down and be open and believe their child.
Yeah.
As it relates to parenting, the primary caregiver, and as it relates to children, particularly the prepubescent and the teenager, the vast majority of their online life is not going to be shared with a parent/primary caregiver.
Right.
As part of the developmental milestones, it's not cool to tell your parents. It's not cool to tell adults what's going on. So the thing is for parents is to recognize that they have online lives, their children, and that they are not going to know really what's going on. I don't know how many parents I've assisted over the years who have said, oh, I know everything that my child does online. And I have to fortunately say, mom, dad, I'm sorry. You know, probably very little, or what you do know, it's very much sugarcoated. So that being said, it's important for parents to do what they can. They don't have to have PhDs in online safety, but take a little time, once a month even on your own, and sit down and Google cyberbullying or cyberbullying prevention and learn a little bit about what are the signs of if your child is being cyberbullied or if your child is the cyberbully.
And on iPredator, you also have a section for trolling, which you've spoken to about in our conversation, but troll triad is something that you have here. Do you want to tell us a little about that?
Yes, troll triad.
That's
okay. And I didn't pay you to bring that up. In 2014, and I won't, you know, use their names, but anybody can read troll triad, is I was targeted for an entire year. And these three folks, one happened to be a dentist, the girlfriend of the dentist, and the other one had an internet radio show. God bless the three of them. Hopefully they're all doing well. But targeted me for a year. One of them, because he knew how to write, you know, he's a good writer, he actually wrote to the New York State Education Department, Office of Professional Displacement, calling for the immediate revocation of my license to practice, saying that I was engaging in attempted homicide by internet. Now, mind you, the state laughed, but they had to do due diligence anyway.
Right.
That was just one thing, the crier. So from that, I realized, and this is back when I realized that internet trolls can run in groups.
Yeah, okay.
This is when I realized not only do they run in groups, but
if there's three or more, they have certain task functions. So whether there's three or 3 million, each internet troll within an internet troll has a task function. So the cerebral is kind of like the brains of the group, the one who thinks about what is going to be the disinformation campaign. What is it? How am I going to write out how I'm going to slander or character assassinate? The second archetype is the provocateur. The provocateur then takes that, let's say, fake news or whatever that campaign is, and begins to go out into social media and begins to essentially go, see, look what this person is doing. This is why the provocateur kind of tries to create, using a ruse, tries to get a group of online users to support the cerebrals, you know, nonsensical stuff. The crier in my situation had his own internet radio show, and he enlisted his listeners to target me. So obviously that isn't ever, but the crier archetype now takes the information from the cerebral and the provocateur and now goes out and spreads it like seeds on a freshly, you know, dug up lawn. And each of them have their own task functioning, working in a group.
Okay. And so this triad, this might exist, you know, this concept could exist, but people might not know, obviously, that they're in these roles. Is that fair to say?
Of course. I mean, there's always a leader. So, I mean, you know, but the leader could essentially be, you know, intellectually compromised and he or she is not the smart one of the bunch. And again, of Troll Triad, what I was trying to do and still believe, I'm introducing archetypes. And for all of you that, you know, love Carl Jung like me, archetypes are not always followed, but these are ways and it's hard, you know, symbolic representations. These are aspects, I guess is a good term, that individuals would take in a group of online assailants who are planning on trolling a person, a group, an organization, and as we know now, countries. I mean, they now have, you know, paid internet trolls that target nations.
Right. And something that we're seeing, and this isn't on your site, but I'm curious on your take of it. Something we're seeing as a huge cyber scam is romance scams. They still remain. They're very strong. And I was speaking with a friend this weekend, and I was talking to her about scammers, romance scammers, and how terrible their emails are. They sound horrible, but they draw people in somehow. And she shared with me, well, actually, I know someone who's in a romance scam, and she's given away a lot of money, and she knows it, but she stays in it. And I can't wrap my head around that. And I don't know if you have a take on romance scams at all.
Oh, I most certainly have a take on that. And I hate to say, listen, Ms. Hillary, I'm a hopeless romantic. I understand how nice it would be, but I have helped people online that are head over heels in love with another person that lives across the country. They have never met one time offline.
Right.
I've helped people that not only have they not met them offline, but they have not actually seen them on webcam.
Wow.
And these are people, I mean, obviously, there's only two so far that never met, never even spoke to them on webcam. These are older folks.
Yeah.
But to actually think you're in love with somebody and truly believe it, and I don't want to pass judgment, but... Right. What they're getting involved in is the fantasy of love, the fantasy of what they think that other person is like and what it would be like. And in their mind, just like cyberspace is a fantasy and it's an illusion, the idea of being in love is also part of this fantasy that we could pretty much agree is almost assuredly not real.
Right.
Not to say that the person on the other end is creating a facade or catfishing, looking to jack you for money, albeit that occurs, But even if the other person is honest and genuine in their response and their presentation, it is highly likely that if the two were to meet offline and over the course of weeks and months, they'd have a very different perception of what they believe is the relationship.
Right. Yeah. Just like when you move in together, you know.
Exactly.
Who are you? What's happening? This is what? Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And as far as how we're going to just continue, even with what we're learning about social media and its impacts, we're just going to continue to use it more and more, especially with COVID-19 and, you know, working from home and things like this. What do you see on the horizon? Do you think there's going to be anything? I mean, obviously there'll be something new, but like, what do you see on the horizon for us?
I could say the COVID, and unfortunately it's a pandemic, it's caused a lot of, sorrow throughout, not just this country, but the world. Right. But from an eye predator standpoint, and obviously I can't prove it, but I do believe quarantine isolation leads some of us to be more psychologically isolated than we already are. Mm. I believe what the coronavirus is going to do via quarantine and people experiencing boredom and frustration, we are going to see higher rates of cybercrime, cyber stalking, cyberbullying among children, an increase in online child predation. Essentially, I foresee there's going to be an increase because of coronavirus in 7 of the 8 types of eye predator. I don't foresee, an increase in cyber terrorism because we've been blessed by not having to deal with it. But I do foresee an increase in all, 7 of these type of unfortunate activities because of the COVID.
Right. Right. And it's going to be interesting, just quickly, when you mentioned, kids, it's going to be interesting developmentally how they develop being so rooted in cyberspace. That's really going to be interesting.
Well, thank you. And I should be calling you. I mean, think about it this, Hillary, is that the vast majority of today's children who are using mobile devices to communicate, when I don't know, for me, I'm 55. So when I was a child and, I was actually on school grounds, I was outside in my community. When I was a kid, the big new tech advancement was the little square text beeper that you wore on your pants.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, that was cool. But all of the exchange, all the social interactions were done what? Face to face.
Right.
So when I met a pretty girl, I was nervous to stand in front of or in the same neighborhood or in the same school of that girl,
Yeah.
Today, children do not experience the nonverbal communications. They're not learning interpersonal skills that you would normally be learning if you didn't have a device in front of you. Sorry, it just gets my gets me going when I think about how much time. Ms. Hillary, it was 2 weeks ago. I was down, and there were a couple, and obviously, I don't know who they were, that you could tell they were, if they weren't on the first date, it had to be in the first couple of dates. And I was just looking at them. I mean, obviously, in this particular restaurant, they were, here in Brooklyn, there were some places where you're allowed to eat. And yeah. I saw them. And instead of looking at one another and playing the uncomfortable game, which is so cute, they were actually looking at their iPhones or their mobile devices instead of one another. And when I saw that, I was like, am I just getting old or am I old school, old fashioned and think we should be looking at each other and flirting as opposed to looking at my mobile device?
Yeah, no, that's bizarre. And my husband and I talk about that a lot just because we met while you still met people in person, I guess. And we have friends who are single who are on Tinder and Hinge and things like this. And we're just like, oh my God, thank God. We'll just like look at each other and be like, thank God. But do you think that that's creating a new level of or a new type of predation as far as this online dating and the culture?
Certainly. Online dating. And again, you know, God bless Match.com, eHarmony, all the other online dating forums, but it's important to be careful. I have helped people that have gone through online dating. I don't knock it, but if you're going to meet somebody, you know, you first have to meet in a public place before you move in. And I tell folks at least three times in a public arena, whether it be a mall, a shopping center, a restaurant that has high volume, is you meet in a public place at least three times before you move to the apartment, and then obviously intimate relations.
Yeah. And something that I always, I guess, lecture or mother my friends on is like, you have to tell someone. Like, you have, if you're not going to tell someone that you're going, that your friend, family member, whatever, that you're going to meet this person, then obviously there's a red flag and you need to listen to that and listen to your gut there.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm hoping that your listeners will take what, I mean, goodness gracious, Ms. Hillary, you know quite a bit about and about what it means to be an online assailant. I'm hoping that your listeners will begin to think about the psychology of the online assailant, and not just the online assailant, but their own psychology and their own, you know, aspects about them and how it impacts what they do online. Because that is the whole point of iPredator, is to introduce the psychology of the cyber criminal. By the grace of God, I don't know if you know, his name is Stanton Samanow. Actually had to read his book back in grad school, Inside the Criminal Mind, in 1984. Well, in 2014, Dr. Samanow wrote the updated edition to Inside the Criminal Mind. And I wish I could have gotten a tattoo, Ms. Hillary. On page 63, Dr. Samanow quoted me. Related to cyberbullying. And to this day, out of anything, I am so humbled by Dr. because, as you know, he's considered one of the greats of introducing, you know, the criminal mind to those of us that study criminal psychology and criminology.
Yeah, that's incredible. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Well, Michael, it's been great speaking with you. I think that, kind of your closing remarks of encouraging our listeners to think about their own online psychology and habits and maybe their odor, how they're doing in their, you know, personal lives and how that impacts their online hygiene and behavior. I think that that's really strong. And I think that's powerful to leave folks with. And thank you so much for your time and for joining us to talk about these really interesting issues.
Oh, thank you. And I guess most importantly is that everything at my website is public domain. It's free. Whether you download any of my 28, 29 checklists or inventories, you don't even have to give an email to download any of my work, all my images. Everything is public domain for educational purposes. And you don't have to write or thank me or pay me attribution. What I'm asking folks is to just think about it. And if you don't like my work, well, there is an entire body of work. It's called Cybercrime Magazine. Spend time there and try your best to be open to learning different aspects of whether it be cybercrime or what I believe is the cyber criminal mind, the psychology of the online assailant, AKA the iPredator.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. This has been great.
Thank you, Ms. Hillary.
Of course. I'm Hillary McClure, Multimedia Director at Cybercrime Magazine. Joining me today was Dr. Michael Nucitelli, a New York State licensed psychologist practicing in Brooklyn, who is also a cyber psychology researcher, online safety educator, and founder of iPredator. To learn more about iPredator, visit iPredator.co. And you can listen to all of our podcast episodes at cybercrime.radio.